This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Travel. My name is Gary Aaron, coming to you from finally somewhat warm Minneapolis, Minnesota. The gang's all back from another live show we did at TBEX this year, this time in Huntsville, Alabama. Joining me again, Mr. Chris Christensen. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, thanks, Gary. I'm off the road after most of a month on traveling, so it's kind of nice to be home.
Yeah, you're traveling more than I am lately.
Well, just this last month. I didn't travel that much in winter, but then spring has been a little busier.
And after Huntsville, you went to North Carolina, is that correct?
Well, after Huntsville, I went to Gulf Shores on a post-trip for TBEX, enjoyed the beach down there, then drove back to Huntsville, seeing some of the national parks on the way, and then picked up my wife, and we explored Huntsville, and then we went down to Vicksburg, and also over to Poverty Point, before we headed in different directions, and then I headed over to North Carolina for the North American Travel Journalism Association.
I have been to Poverty Point.
Hey, Chris, I thought you didn't go to Poverty Point until after you retired.
Poverty Point is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, which is why I bring it up when talking to Gary. The Indian Mounds.
I've been there. And it's a National Park Service site, but you wouldn't know it.
I did not know that, in fact, until I got there and they said, oh, yeah, we're a national park. I had to go back into the car to get my national park passport to stamp it. So,
yeah, it's a weird deal the state of Louisiana has set up. That voice you just heard was, of course, the wonderful Jen Leo. How are you doing, Jen?
Nice to see you guys. I'm doing great. I can't wait for summer. I have not been traveling outside of the TBEX, so I cannot wait for Cora to get out of school so we can hit the road.
The TBEX.
Where are you going to be going?
We are going to Yosemite for a family reunion, followed by a couple days in San Francisco.
Not
and
shabby.
We're having a staycation this weekend for my birthday over at Lake Resort in San Marcos. We're going to take a party boat out and have some time at the pool.
You know, the one problem with having to rely on the school calendar for visiting Yosemite is that you always end up with the crowds at the peak in that summertime.
Yep, I'm sure it'll be tough.
Yeah, as if you could go, you know, even a month or a couple of weeks sooner, you could always avoid a lot of that.
And it's a family reunion type thing, so we've got anywhere from a 2-year-old to a 71-year-old. So it's always amusing to see the Leos try to get anywhere when we're together.
As you get to those endpoints in age, they're kind of the same.
Gary would know.
Yeah, I'm just over that hump now, so I'm going back into... down the hill. And also with us, also back from Huntsville, where we met up at TBEX, Mr. Max Hartshorn, who's the editor at GoNomad.com. And the first time on the show, I think, right?
Yeah, it's good to join you guys, my travel buddies, from all my meetings I have and all the times I see you guys at TBEX and VMEX and all the other MEXs that we all get to be involved with. Good to be with you. I'm in Nemo Colon Resort in the far reaches of Pennsylvania, almost next to West Virginia. Very swish resort, actually, for this part of the country. A big fancy wedding I'm going to this weekend. So that's what's happening with me.
I came down with Nemo Colon one time, and that was not pretty.
I'm very big into punctuation, and I always prefer the Nemo Colon as opposed to the semicolon. I think one of the big news stories is... there was the laptop ban that went into effect for flights that were coming from certain Middle Eastern countries. And this actually happened while Chris and I were at TBEX in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. The announcement, I think, came out while we were there, which kind of threw a lot of people for a loop because they were flying back to the U.S. through Turkey. And it affected flights coming from Turkey. And the United States then wanted to extend it to everything coming from Europe. But the most recent thing we've been told is that it's kind of off the table now. So it probably is not going to be happening. But evidently they had some sort of intel or some sort of information that terrorists were planning an attack. They were going to put it inside a laptop, and they had discovered a way that they could put it in but still turn the laptop on, which, to be real honest, I don't think is that challenging, especially if you're using an older computer that's bigger. It has like a CD drive in it or something. But how big of a problem? Let's, you know, and they still could do this. How much do you think it would actually impact or affect flights if you couldn't carry electronics on board planes?
Well, I was one of those people who flew back through Istanbul and couldn't carry electronics on a plane except for your cell phone. And it's a hassle. It's definitely a hassle. I think we talked about this on the show. I can't find any evidence that we did from the show notes, but I thought we talked about this a couple weeks ago. But, you know, I thought they dealt with it fairly reasonably for how Turkish Airlines, who I was flying, was dealing with it. They were checking at the gate each individual electronic item, your SLR, your laptop, your tablet, and then, you know, taking your name, putting it individually in bubble wrap, and putting it in a special suitcase that they brought out, and then you checked back out again, your electronics at the end. So I thought they handled it well. But, you know, it's tough to give up those electronic devices. I prefer to just accidentally leave them in rental cars instead.
The worst one I heard was the poor woman talking about what it's like to fly with a child. Jen, you can relate to this. Imagine a little kid that's like on the iPad, and like the only saving grace is they're on the friggin' iPad, and you can't give them the iPad, and you got a 17-hour flight or whatever, 12-hour flight to Dubai, and your little kid is crying. I mean, I can just imagine that would be a real nightmare scenario.
Yeah, I mean, usually you're talking about usually having an electronic entertainment system at least. So there, it's not like there's no entertainment, but it's not the entertainment the child is used to.
I thought I read that in some of the cases they were trying to do workarounds where they were lending out tablets and stuff.
They were doing that at first class on some airlines. That's true.
First class. Jeez, that's not enough.
Sorry, not coach.
We've rented a tablet before, and I don't know why we needed to, but we did rent a tablet before, and it worked great. And what Cora liked about that is that it was movies and games that she didn't have on hers necessarily, so she was trying all new stuff. So that was good. But it's not so. Yeah. I mean, Cora's 8. I can reason with her. She can read a book. She can draw. We can play card games. There's a lot of stuff that's an alternative, but when your kid is like 1.5 to 3.5, that's when they don't quite understand.
Well, you know, it's a good thing that terrorists do not fly through Asia, because otherwise, man, that'd be a real problem. But thankfully, no terrorist would ever fly through an Asian country to get to the United States. So you only have to worry about European flights.
Yeah, and I noticed Saudi Arabia wasn't on the list. Oh, I wonder why that is.
Yeah, there seems to be always kind of a big loophole when it comes to Saudi Arabia, except when you realize that, like, what, 18 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Yes. Osama bin Laden. Yeah, exactly.
And I think most of the foreign ISIS fighters are from Saudi Arabia. And, yeah, it's the biggest, you know, kind of hole in, you know, of all the countries that are on the watch list that require you to get extra screening or something, Saudi Arabia is not one of them.
Mm-hmm. No, it's the reason why I still pretty much don't believe that this is a security issue.
Oh, no, I think it has something to do with the airlines.
The Middle Eastern airlines have really eaten the lunch of a lot of the airlines. In fact, one of the stories that we had was that in response to this laptop ban, was it Etihad that has decreased their number of flights by 20%? So that's just exactly what – oh, sorry, Emirates has cut flights to the U.S. by 20% and blames Trump. And that is really what the intention was, I believe, of the ban.
Well, it's also the repercussions of the proposed travel ban. I mean, that totally, even though it didn't go into place, thank God the second one didn't go into place either, but that took a huge toll. We're going to the IPW next month, and I just read some stats about, tourism into the U.S. is down like 11%. That's pretty serious, and they're got to be from a lot of those countries. So it makes sense for them to close, stop the flights.
Hopefully we'll see what happens, but, I, for one, don't want them to do anything. Another thing, there are some security experts I follow online. And, one of them pointed out that if they can, first of all, the ability to put a bomb in a laptop and make the laptop appear to work is not that hard. Like I said, especially if you're using an older laptop, there's lots of spaces you can put things, like an extra drive bay or something like that. But also, you can probably detonate it through Wi-Fi. Or Bluetooth, or, and there's more screening that goes on when you go through security as a passenger than if you put it in a checked bag. So it's not necessarily increasing security.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, you can do it, have it from the hold as well as from your check-in. Yeah.
Well, I think we need to go to our weekly someone getting kicked off a plane story. this week is Delta. And the headline for this is Delta apologizes after threatening parents with jail time over a seat they purchased. Let me just say, it's about time we start cracking down on these people using seats that they buy. Airlines don't make money flying people. They make money selling tickets. What happened is, so this family bought a set of tickets. You have two parents, three children. The children were a teenager and then a one-year-old and a two-year-old. The teenager ended up getting put on an earlier flight, and so then they wanted to use the seat that the teenager was going to use for a two-year-old instead of sitting on their lap. The flight, surprise, surprise, was overbooked, and Delta wanted to give the seat to someone else, even though the family had paid for it. Conflict ensues. Gate agents overreact. Of course, the smartphones come out, they start filming things, and the apology ensues. Do you think that the family was in the right if they purchased the ticket, but the person whose name on the ticket wasn't on the flight, that they can use that seat?
Technically, no, because they're not transferable. But on the other hand, this is not something that the airline should have a problem with. That's it's the security issues of whether or not you can transfer a ticket apart. If somebody pays for four seats and they're using four seats, the airline should be happy.
Yeah, but it gets into the problem of overbooking again.
Well, that's a separate issue.
Well, the question also is, did they arrange with the gate agent and say, teenager B isn't here, so toddler C will take the seat? They should have told. Maybe they made, did they make arrangements to tell anybody? Or they just take the seat.
Well, the other question too is, did they only purchase four tickets and one of them got transferred onto an earlier flight? In which case, they had not purchased this. If they didn't pay for a seat for the 1 year old, then, and they only purchased four tickets, but one of the seats they used basically is on an earlier flight, then they really didn't purchase this ticket. And it wasn't clear from the reporting whether they paid and bought another ticket for the teenager. It did not sound like they did. It sounded like they thought, well, we still have four seats here, even though our teenager went earlier. But if he went earlier on his ticket, they didn't have four seats. They'd only purchased three on this flight. And it wasn't clear from the story.
Sounds complicated, and if the kid's on two and under, I think we're under two, they don't have to pay for a seat. But I would totally feel like if I had bought the seat and my other kid didn't use it, and it was still my seat, I would feel like I could use it for the toddler.
Well, but again, it's not your seat if the ticket that goes for that seat got used on an earlier flight. If they bought another ticket on the earlier flight, it's different.
Right, because then you transferred that one to, whatever you were using it. So that's, therein lies the gray area. But don't you think these days, with everything that's been going on with this, everybody would just be a little more flexible on both sides, people and the airlines, because of just recent incidents.
Well, if it was United, I'm sure that they wouldn't have given them that much, you know, hassle because
because
of fear. So
that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Everybody being a little more flexible.
So it's, you know, it's always good as an airline to beat somebody up every once in a while because then people will behave better. So,
but I think also it for any families that are traveling, especially ones with the littlest of kids, always check in with the gate, even if you think you have your seat assignment, and double check that everybody's together and that people haven't been separated for any kind of weird reasons. I know that Cora and I don't have the same last name. And so when she was smaller, I think we might have had an issue where we got separated because the name was changed. And but it's always you don't want that stress at the last minute, especially.
Right. No, that's
if you have a
really good idea. Yeah.
So just go, you know, when you're lining up and you're about to go on, do your pre-boarding because you've got a kid under 4 or 5. Just go up to the gate and check in to make sure that you are still sitting together, even if you have a ticket that. It's just, you know, better safe than stressed.
Well, and if you've got, you know, if Cora was like 2 or 3 at the time, you can always walk up to the gate agents and say, I see you haven't put us together. I appreciate that you're going to have somebody else watch my 2 and 3 year old. I could really use a break. She's a handful. Thanks so much. And see how quickly. They...
right.
There you go. Yeah.
And if you have a child that's less than 2, like if you have an infant, I remember that I was always sort of checking in to see if it was possible to get bulkhead space.
Sure.
When she was an infant, and you know, when you're flying to London and she's 6 months old, any little bit of extra space is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And they have those bassinets. So if you have an infant and they have the bassinet and the bulkhead, it's really helpful. And it's hard to get that space when you're just booking online or whatever, but sometimes they save those and you can get them at the gate.
Right.
Well, speaking of infants, Jen, United States recently brought in for questioning a 3-month-old terrorist because he's from England, and his grandfather's family is planning a trip to the United States. And there's this form that you're required to fill out before coming here. And one of the questions is, do you seek to engage in or have you engaged in terrorist activities, espionage, sabotage, or genocide? And the grandfather screwed up and put down yes for the 3-month-old. And so they called in the 3-month-old for questioning. And I always kind of wondered what the purpose of that question was.
It's an intelligence test.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, it's like, are you lying?
Well, who's going to answer yes to that? You know?
Well, exactly. It can only be – the only person that's going to put down yes is someone who screws up, and then they're going to have to follow up with it because someone said they engaged in terrorist activities. I wonder if there's ever been a single case of someone saying, oh yeah, I'm a terrorist. I'm an honest terrorist. So I just wanted to check the box.
Well, I suspect that the child is colicky and the grandfather intentionally checked terrorist. So.
Could be. he said he did sabotage his diapers. So. Another report, and I remember reading this online. So a father was returning from Mexico into the United States with his 3-year-old daughter. After the flight, he was detained by customs and border officials on the basis of sex trafficking. He had the passport for his daughter. He had everything. He had a signed and notarized letter from the mother, which I guess you're supposed to have if you only have one parent or something. And everything was cool, but one of the passengers thought something was fishy, therefore, you know, he had to get brought in on this issue of sex trafficking because people see this in the news and they think that nothing but sex trafficking ever goes on. I don't know if we've had a story like this on the show, but we've had other stories in the past where some passenger is not comfortable with something, just I don't like that person, or I think they look fishy, And then the airline or some other official has to take some sort of action. Do you think that's a good standard?
Well, it's the see something, say something. I mean, the times, I'd rather have sometimes that it's a mistake and catch the one time that it's something really serious. But on the other hand, some people just need to get out more. You know, I didn't see anything in this report that said there was any signs of what would have been a sex trafficking. You know, the child seemed to be quite comfortable, for instance, with the adult. She's sleeping on his lap during the plane, and there seemed to be, from the reporting and the eyewitnesses, a emotional bond between the three-year-old. Max, I think you're brushing your earbuds on your clothes there. And the adult. So I don't think that this was, from what was saying, a really good use of the see something, say something. This is the imagine something, say something. So,
you know, one of my problems, though, with a policy like this, I mean, it's easy to say, well, if they get the one time.
Yeah.
The problem is, you know, and this happens with the TSA, it's like it's all false positives, right? Every time this happens, it's pretty much a false positive. And I can't think of a case where someone's like, hey, this guy's weird. Oh, and it turns out they were a terrorist and they're trying to kill everyone. That pretty much never happens. It's pretty much all false positives. And when it's nothing but false positives, you tend to become very lax when you see something because you're, you know, the odds are almost 100% that it's not going to be something legitimate and real.
But, yeah. I think better safe than sorry. I mean, they also had the note from the mom, and on the other end, once they held them, they called the mom just to verify that everything was correct. I don't know. I mean, I kind of like you, Chris. I'd just rather be safe about this kind of thing.
There's no repercussion. So if somebody just annoys you on a flight, what is to stop you from just saying, hey, oh, I think this person is a threat? Nothing will happen to you for doing it.
That actually is illegal, to make a false report. But
no,
proving
it's not
to somebody,
a false report.
Proving that
you
somebody...
You just say, I feel threatened.
Well,
I think they're fishy.
Yeah.
They're not saying they are a terrorist. You're not saying, you're not lying. All of these cases we've had involve just that. It's like, well, I think this person is you know, suspicious.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. There's no... You know, there's no consequence to, like, if you get it wrong. You're just supposed to say anything that, like I said, if you don't get out more often and you're not familiar with people, you're going to think everything is suspicious. On a lighter note, it's actually, now that we're done with sex trafficking and terrorism, I don't think we've talked about this on the show. But I this kind of bothered me when I heard it because it kind of sucks. Bangkok wants to get rid of street food. And this is probably the best city in the world for street food. I have eaten many, many, many meals on the streets of Bangkok. I have gotten drunk many times on the streets of Bangkok. And they want to get rid of all the stalls and the street vendors. It's really kind of too bad. I mean, have you guys eaten on the streets
more
of Bangkok?
Recent, I heard more recent reporting that said that wasn't quite the case. So I'm not quite sure about the background in this story.
Well, they want to, I think, put people in designated areas.
Okay.
Whereas right now you could just kind of set up on the sidewalk anywhere you want. They had those little guys even with like the motorbikes with like the wok attached to it and the propane tank and things like that. And they could just pull up anywhere. So I think the goal is to make Bangkok more like Singapore. And to a certain extent, this does exist in Bangkok. There are certain places next to like the BTS stations.
Sure.
Where they do have kind of these food centers, these impromptu food centers. And I think they want to make that more formal just to kind of clean up and, you know, make the sidewalks and the streets not so busy. But have you guys eaten on the streets there?
I
yes,
have.
And I want my banana pancakes.
I have definitely eaten from vendors. I don't remember whether I ate from some of the ones that were just like just outside the train station or things like that.
Yeah, it's really too bad. And I think, you know, what Bangkok wants to do, I think there's a lot of cities in Asia, they really kind of would like to become more of a Singapore. You know, Bangkok has that, and the same is true, I think, in like Saigon, Hanoi, maybe to a lesser extent, Kuala Lumpur, which I think is a little bit more, you know, kind of developed and clean. But they want to kind of develop an image of being a bit more of a high class city than kind of what they've been. And I think they view this as sort of a step in that direction. But we'll see. It's going to be very different going to Bangkok. They want to kind of end it by the end of 2017. So I think it's going to be interesting the next time I go to Bangkok to go down the street and not see this because I was so used to, you know, you're usually never more than a block or two away from a street vendor.
Well, and, you know, I'd say for me, the line is when they get rid of the places with the great mango smoothie, you know, then I say it's time for a call to arms, you know, at that point, because you can have my coconut or mango smoothie when you pry it out of my cold dead hands, but
well, Max, this is your first time on the show, so why don't you give everyone kind of a bit of a background about what you do with Go Nomad and how you got involved in the world of travel.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah, it's great to be here with you guys. I know all of you individually so well, and it's just fun to be a part of something that's been going for a while. And I've enjoyed listening to the podcast a number of times, so I'm trying to do my best. So I'm editor of GoNomad.com, a travel site based in Western Massachusetts. We've been publishing since the year 2000. Proud about that. You know, we've been around for a real long time, and I bought the site in 2002. And we actively encourage bloggers and travel writers to submit articles to us. We publish an article every day. So we have a big appetite for freelancers and great, well-written articles. And I get to travel about 12 times a year, 10, 12 times a year, and write myself. And it's a lot of fun, especially publishing people's stories. Some of the most amazing stories come in, and I'm just out of the woodwork. You know, after being around for a couple, almost two decades, you get people know who you are, and they know that you publish good articles. So they come in droves, and my email is just a joy, you know, all the different places that people are going and the stories that people are writing and really, really doing a great job of it. So that's what I'm doing now.
Now, Max, you said two things in there that I didn't know. One is that you bought the site, that you didn't build it originally.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I always recommend that to people. I say, if you want to get in the web business, buy a site with an old domain. If you can imagine, you remember 2002. I mean, 2001, we were all freaking out. And I signed the deal to buy the site in February. I closed on it February 02. And that was a perfect time to buy the site because everybody thought it was just going down like nothing was going to be left. But, you know, I think buying a site with an existing sort of framework, it already had traffic on it. It was already had a lot of stories on it. And I always suggest if people want to get in the business, you know, find somebody that wants to sell and build what they're doing up. In fact, at our TBEX, last TBEX, Huntsville, Maria made a neat presentation about buying websites and about basically adding value to something that's great, but making it better would be even better.
And
so that's sort of my suggestion.
How did you come across Go Nomad at the time, and how did you know that they wanted to sell?
Well, because I used to work for a print magazine called Transitions Abroad, which is based in Amherst, Massachusetts. And
I remember that name.
Yeah, you remember Transitions?
Mm-hmm.
They're still around, though, as a website, aren't they?
No, the magazines, well, the website's going strong. I mean, Greg does a great job, but the magazine, the print magazine, was where I was working. And at the time, we had a content exchange program where we used to sell content to Go Nomad. And she would call me up and say, hey, you know, what do you got for me this month? You know, we're going to do our new issue. And finally, I just said, look, you know, I really don't like this print very much. I'd really rather just, let's talk about buying your website. So she said, yeah, let's talk about it. So she pretty much, she was thinking she was going to negotiate with Transitions Abroad, and I kind of hijacked it and said, no, no, you're dealing with me. So I wanted to leave. I didn't like the print much at all. Print is just so limiting and so many things you can't do. And ridiculous lead time. You can't even fix something if you do it wrong. So I just really was unforgiving, you know, compared to our web publishing, which is just so much smoother. So I just grabbed it and said, let's work it out. And she spent the owner, her name is Lauren, And Lauren spent 2 years traveling with the proceeds, you know, over the course of the, I just paid her in installment payments. Wherever she was in the world, I'd send her a check. And it worked out. And only 2 years, it took me like 2 years to make it my full-time job.
I have a friend who just sold his website. It was just a travel blog that he started, but he wanted to refocus and focus on scuba diving. So he took the money that he, and he made a fair amount of money off the sale, and he's kind of using that as seed capital then to start this new venture, kind of having spent the last couple of years learning how to do blogging.
Yeah, I mean, that, really... the thing about the old domain, I mean, it's just like if you start something in 2017 compared to if you get a domain that's old, that's been cranking along for so long, I mean, that just makes a huge difference. It's the only time when age is really appreciated is websites.
And the other thing I didn't know is you said you were based in Western Massachusetts, which is not a hotbed for web activity. Where are you based?
I live in Deerfield, Massachusetts, which is near Amherst, where the University of Massachusetts is. And Smith College is right there. And it's a beautiful part of the world. We call it the Pioneer Valley. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of interesting people there, a lot of people that are overeducated and underpaid and living there because they love living in that part of the world. You know, we know it. We have no traffic jams. We have cheap rent. We have very educated people, and everybody's as blue as they come, if you know what I mean.
It's a cold place is what you're saying.
Never mind. During TBEX Huntsville, you actually went and visited the the Unclaimed Baggage?
Yeah,
center.
What a great place. The Unclaimed.
I didn't
unclaimed
go.
Baggage
I actually, I drove kind of past it. I went on a really long trip afterwards. But what was it like?
Oh, it was great. You know, I just love it. I love especially the people that run it are very savvy. I mean, they sponsored a whole party at TBEX, and they really knew what they were doing. You know, they have people that are, you know, content managers, and they have photographers, and they're very savvy with their marketing. And it's in a town called Scottsboro. And, you know, Chris, you're a history guy. You know about Scottsboro. I mean, it's a town that basically almost lynched people, you know, these Scottsboro boys. That's what Scottsboro is famous for. So thank God Scottsboro, Alabama is famous for something else besides the Scottsboro boys. It's just great. You go in and huge, big selection. In fact, I'm on a iPad that I bought for $100 at the Unclaimed Baggage Center. And they have so many things that they sell. One of the things that really was sort of sad, though, is I saw a woman walking by, and she was holding 3 wedding dresses. I thought, what a story that must have been. You know, what a bummer. You lost your luggage. It's basically the airlines have 90 days to return somebody's luggage to them. And they make a lot of effort. They do diligence. They look at all the electronics. But a lot of people's laptops and electronics don't have any identification on them at all, which is, by the way, if you're flying, you know, slap your name on your iPad, for God's sake, because people leave them in the seat back pockets all the time. And so they get they buy, it's just like that Storage Wars, you know. They go and they buy a container full of suitcases, unopened, and they get to open them. And they told us a little bit about what they find in these suitcases. One of the things they find a lot is good old cash. He said people send money in suitcases all the time. And drugs. They said drugs are sewn into clothes oftentimes. And these would clearly be the bags that you would not pick up at the baggage, you know, the baggage carousel. Well, they end up in Alabama, in Scottsboro, Alabama.
Huh. that part surprises me. I just never would have thought that you would claim your suitcase full of, well, I guess if we get lost and then, you know, what are you going to do? Fill out a form. What's inside it?
Yeah, well, they also think about the unmarked luggage,
bills,
you know?
Yeah. And drugs.
Well, you wouldn't want to have a really accurate name tag on your bag of cocaine, you know, so you probably would just not have no name tag on it. But what's interesting, too, is the it's a real tourist attraction. I mean, this part of Alabama is a poor part of Alabama. It's northeastern Alabama. Mostly, you know, most of the business there is timber. And so this has turned into a real tourism attraction. People come in and they have these fun games that they play. Every day they have a fun game in the place. It's really an experience. You go in and they give you a suitcase and they show you, they have two things. They have they show you how they inspect the suitcases and how carefully they have to look. And every little nook and cranny, you'd be surprised how many things they find. But they have another thing. They have a game where they give three contestants 1 minute, and whoever can put on the most clothes in 1 minute wins the prize. And so these, you know, people are throwing on hats and put on watches and putting on scarves and putting on four pairs of pants and three shirts, you know, just to try to win the contest to see who can get dressed the fastest.
And Max, I'm going to ask you again, if you could hold your microphone from your earbuds out away from your clothes. We're getting quite a lot of brushing noises.
Huh. I don't know if you remember, but there used to be a Travel Channel show that was like Storage Wars,
no,
but for unclaimed luggage. I don't know. I don't think it was more than a season they did it. But yeah, it was kind of the same premise. Basically, people buy stuff unseen, open it up.
Oh, I remember that. Yes, Gary, I remember that. It was a short-lived kind of a takeoff on Storage Wars, and you'd bid on the suitcases. And if it was like an Armani suitcase, that it would pay more because it was a nice-looking suitcase, and you'd open it up, and you never know what was in it. Yeah, it didn't last as long as Storage Wars. But the other thing about unclaimed baggage is they have a really nice cafe in there, and they have electronics. And that's the thing that most people go for, you know, the electronics. As I mentioned, this iPad, you know, I went to the electronics area, and they have all these, like, one of the things they have the most is, boy, if you ever want a charger of any kind, of any description, and they have all these cameras without chargers, which is kind of useless. But one of our friends there picked up three little cameras for $10 each, three small little SLR, digital SLRs. And she needed them for something, but it was just the kind of thing like this. This iPad was $100, and a lot of laptops, a lot of interesting things like surfboards. Like, who would leave a surfboard and not claim it? You know, it's odd that some of the things they have, just big things, a suit of armor, a giant suit of armor. You actually check that in a bag. The other thing that they have is that apparently they also sell things that were lost in shipping containers. So they have like regular, you know, they'll have 100 of a piece, or, you know, so it's not just one-offs. It's some of it is unclaimed shipping, apparently. And it's not only trains. I mean, it's all only planes, but it's buses, it's trains, and it's airplanes. But they said the quality of luggage from Greyhound is 90% junk, unfortunately. Not to knock any bus riders, but apparently they don't have as good luggage as the flyers do.
Max, did you buy anything interesting?
Yes, I did. I got the iPad, and I got a pair of these 1960 groovy-looking boots, which totally don't fit. I mean, I had to have the boots, you know. And then I bought a little device for my grandson, a little iPad, you know, iPods, but way back, iPod, those small little iPods. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I spent my money. I definitely gave them a good run.
Yeah, Johnny Jett was saying that he didn't think the value of like electronics was necessarily that great. And I'm guessing.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's not the best. It's not like the absolute highest quality you've ever seen. Like some of the stuff, like some of the cameras, especially, Gary, you would have been like, oh, God, I don't want that. You know, it's like, you know, 3-year-old DSLRs or 2-year-old mini cameras. Not like the state of the art. But once in a while, you know, like a laptop or an iPad. And those are great. I have my iPad's actually fairly new.
No, I kind of drove past it on my way back to Huntsville. I drove all the way to South Carolina and back, and then I saw the signs for it. I didn't realize because I saw signs for it in Huntsville, and I thought it was in Huntsville. But it's an hour outside of Huntsville, isn't it?
Yeah, Scottsboro, yeah, way out. In fact, in that part of the world, they gave us a little tour before we went to the unclaimed baggage center. And it's a beautiful part of the world, Alabama. They have all these waterfalls, and they had a beautiful big state park, DeKalb State Park we went to, and they toured around, and it was really very pretty. We stayed on a lake with Roger Wade and I were there, and it was quite an interesting part of the world. We met some artists, and they said, you know, this part of the world nobody knows about, but this is a great part of the world. There's a lot of artists and writers who have moved there in this little town. I can't remember the name of it, but just again, it's a very sparsely populated part of the world, so you can a lot of country and a lot of parks and stuff.
Yeah, I went up to, on my way to South Carolina, I drove north. I went up to Russell Cave, which is a National Park Service site. And basically, it's the cave itself is not much. You can't really go inside. It's an archaeological site. But yeah, it's a very beautiful area. And I think a lot of people, and I think one of the the reasons that a place like Huntsville, because I think when it was announced, a lot of people were like, Alabama, because I think there is a natural desire to go to like sexy places. Although I should say the year they had it in New York, that was the year they voted. And everyone said, oh, it's good to have, you know, T-Bex in New York. And then when they did it, everyone just started complaining about the price of everything.
Well, yeah, it was expensive. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Oh, Huntsville was great.
Places like Huntsville that I don't think are on people's radar. And there are lots of them all over the country that are great places to visit. But most people have absolutely no idea because there's a couple places that kind of suck up all the oxygen.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the whole state of Alabama doesn't even register for most people. I mean, I got these looks like I was telling people, hey, I'm going to Alabama next week for this conference. They look at me like, Alabama?
Yeah.
I said, no. I said, but there's more PhDs in Huntsville than any place. They said, really? Huntsville? That sounds okay, but Alabama? I said, I've been there 3 times. I thought it's great. You know, and I think also, like, if you guys saw that letter that they wrote, I mean, the people from Huntsville and the people who sponsored that were the most gracious, sweetest people. They absolutely genuinely were happy we were there. And I'd rather be at a place where I'm 100% welcome and things are really reasonable and fun. And like, we're so glad you're here versus like, oh yeah, you're another conference. You know, we don't care about you. We're too cool for school, you know?
Well, one of the things I enjoyed when I was at T-Bex is one of the people who is attending, who listens to This Week in Travel, said, I really wasn't going to come because I wasn't impressed that it was going to be in Huntsville. And then I heard the show that you did in the preview when I went out to Huntsville and we talked about it. He said, well, that actually sounds interesting. So he came and he caught me at the last party and said, I've got to come back. So yeah. I was like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, some of those venues that they had were so cool. I mean, that first night when they had that venue with that neat, I'd never even seen a place like that. The biggest bar and restaurant complex with like 4 different bands playing. And every time they did stuff, it was unique. It was not the same. It was just, they really put on really good musicians, and I thought the food was pretty good, and I just really, Huntsville really impressed me.
You know, one thing that was funny is when we did the preview show, we had, you know, 6 of us had gone on the preview trip, and we went to the Science Museum, the Missile Space and Center out there, and they had arranged for one of the docents to give us a tour guide, you know, somebody who'd been in charge of the F1 engine or at least had worked on that project. And I'm thinking, well, that's really great, but of course that's not something that everybody else is going to get when they just walk in. Well, when my wife was there, we just walked in, we bought a ticket, they had no idea who we were, and we ran into 2 different rocket scientists who were docents there and spent, you know, so much time talking to them that we actually had to run to our IMAX ticket showing and things like that. It was fascinating. You're standing in front of the control ring for the Saturn V and saying, well, what did you work on? He said, well, this. This is what I worked on. That's why he was standing there and was talking about, you know, trying to do space flight with early, just barely solid state electronics at that point. They didn't have tubes, but it was pretty darn close, and it was fascinating. And of course, that's something 10 years from now that those guys are not going to be there. These are guys who are now in their 90s. So if you want to do that, you should do it now.
What do you guys think of the Low Mill Arts? I really liked that place.
Yes, too, definitely. I couldn't believe how many artists they could fit in one place, 150 artists. And I love the fact that they opened up their studios. I mean, sometimes you go to a place like that and you can look in the windows, but these people were saying, come on and look what I'm painting. Look at this art I'm doing. And it was sweet. And all up and down, all the stories. And those desserts they had at that place, and everybody was just like, oh, come on and look at what I'm doing. And it was very, again, that welcoming thing of like, you know, look at my art. Check it out. That's very refreshing. I love that low building.
I really love the Davidson Center, which is home to the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. That's home to one of the 3 remaining Saturn V rockets. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Apollo 16 command module is there, the original one. Lots of other stuff. And I think a lot of people forget, or they aren't aware that Huntsville had a big role in going to the moon. They don't, you know, you think of NASA, you think of Florida, Houston, maybe the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, but I think Huntsville kind of gets overlooked a little bit. And, you know, when I was walking around, I grew up, I was a nerd about this stuff. I could tell you the names of all the astronauts on all the missions. And I actually did some walking tours while I was there explaining to everyone how all this stuff worked. And it's kind of sad in a way that in a certain sense, the Apollo missions were kind of like the height, you know, the apex of science or of exploration. And we're going to be coming on the 50th anniversary soon, half a century of when that happened. And we've never done anything like it since. We just kind of like, we did it. And if you think about material science and computers and how bad the computers were in the Apollo missions, your iPhone is thousands of times more powerful. That we could probably do this much easier. I don't know about cheaper, but certainly, you know, our technical ability to do something like this, we can certainly do it. You know, we've done it before, but we don't. And that's kind of sad.
Yeah, now all you have is SpaceX.
Well, at least someone's trying to do something. You know, I think 100 years from now, maybe there won't be a need for a NASA anymore because people will just be able to do this on their own. If the price of getting into orbit can get cheap enough, you know, colleges can just do their own missions to Mars or something because most of the cost is actually in launching the thing. But anyway, this is not This Week in Space. anything else before we move on to our picks of the week?
Just to underline something you were saying, how the costs have not gone down, actually, with the we did a tour of Marshall Space Flight Center, and we went and saw, you know, stood up on some of the gantries and things like that, which was great, or the test stands, rather. And then we also went and saw where they recycled the pee, basically, from the astronauts into water. And he's holding a mason jar full of water that has finally come out the other side and saying, you know, this is how much we get back out of the system. But he says this jar saves us $40,000 because that's what it costs to put up if we had to put up this much water into orbit. It's like, well, you know, that kind of put it in perspective in terms of how expensive it still is to break the bonds of the Earth's gravity.
I have a reader who works at JPL, and I remember I was in Pasadena once, and she emailed me and said, would you like a tour of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory? And I was like, hell yeah. And this was, I got to see, you know, meet the staff that was working on the Cassini mission. This is before it actually arrived in Saturn. It was a really, really great experience, and I've always gone out of my way, whether it's in Hawaii, up on Mauna Kea, in the Canary Islands. I made sure to go to the telescopes in La Palma and like the very large array in New Mexico. I've always kind of gone to science sites anywhere I am in the world. All right, then. Let's move on to our picks of the week. Chris, what do you got for us?
I got nothing. Give me a minute.
I got something.
How many? This is what? Show number 222?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about during the show. I still got nothing. Actually, I got a new podcast for you.
It is coming.
This is a preview. It is a show about travel marketing and PR that will be part of the FIR podcast network. And it's a new show that should be coming out in the next couple weeks. The title of it will probably be Passport, Travel and Marketing PR Podcast, and it will be Leif Pettersson and I will be doing this podcast along with some guests from the travel and marketing PR space. So I'll tell you more about that when that's up, but
awesome, Chris.
Keep your ears out.
Sounds interesting.
What is the FIR Podcast Network?
The FIR Podcast Network is the largest network of PR podcast for immediate release is what the FIR stands for. And that's a 12-year-old show on PR. It's about the same age as Amateur Traveler. I'm not sure if FIR is older or Amateur Traveler is older, but I think it also came out in 2005. And so it's many, many episodes into its run.
All right. I'm looking forward to subscribing to it. Jen, you got something?
I do. And Chris is doing a new one. I'm doing an old site or an old episode that we used to do. There's been a lot of talk about Bitcoin in the news recently. And I just wanted to remind people, we interviewed this guy, God, it's got to be like over a year ago, but blog.bitcoin-traveler.com was an around-the-world trip for 365 days only on Bitcoin.
I remember that.
If you've got the Bitcoin bug, if you've got the fever and you want to see how, I forget what his name is, but if you want to see how he traveled the whole year on Bitcoin, check out Bitcoin Traveler, blog.bitcoin-traveler.com. And I don't remember the name of our episode, but I'm sure it would be easily found, This Week in Travel Plus Bitcoin. And you can hear us talking to this guy. He gave us all sorts of tips, and I can't wait to listen to it again.
I remember that, Jen. That was one of the when I first heard about your podcast, I remember listening to that one. That was a good one.
Oh, nice, Max. Yeah. He's got an accent, so it's you have to listen really carefully, but it was a really good episode.
That was episode 209.
Thank you, Chris.
That's okay. This one's going to be hard to listen to also with all the microphone noises.
Max, do you have something for us this week?
I do, yes. Well, I'm going down to IPW, which is a train ride away from me, from Massachusetts to Washington, D.C., for the International Powwow IPW meeting, which I'm sure I'm going to see a few of you guys there. But anyway, so I had to book this ticket on Amtrak. And I want to give you a tip. So you go to Amtrak.com. And you put in your destination, and it shows you that it's sold out, and the cheap tickets are sold out, and you can only buy the expensive ticket. Drat, I should have bought the ticket earlier. So refresh the page, get out of the website, go back to the website. Wow, the $96 ticket is suddenly available. So if you have a problem when you're booking an Amtrak ticket, you can only find the expensive ticket, start all over again. And for some reason, they're not that together, but you can buy the cheap ticket oftentimes on the second or third pass. That's my recommendation.
I hate it when sites do that, because you hear about airline sites doing similar things or pricing it differently based on
cookies,
your location.
And things, yeah.
And, yeah. Very annoying.
Well, I saved $90 on the ticket.
All right. Well, my pick this week is a completely self-serving pick. For the last 2 years, I have been working on a project for an online training course for travel photography. Basically, as I've been traveling around the world, I would constantly see people who have spent thousands of dollars on camera equipment and thousands of dollars on trips, and they simply didn't know how to use their camera. They would buy these expensive cameras with the hopes that they would take better pictures, and it just doesn't work that way. And I know that because I did the exact same thing when I started traveling back in 2007. I bought an expensive camera and took a lot of bad photos with it. But over time, I improved. And so I've created a brand new online course called the Travel Photography Academy. And you can go to travelphotographyacademy.com. And I'm assuming this will be out a few days before it, but on June 1st, we're opening up the doors and we're finally taking subscribers. It's a video-based course. I shot a whole bunch of video in Paris, other parts of France and Spain. This is actually after TBEX Costa Brava in 2015. I've done a whole lot of voiceover work. We have a bunch of great photographers lined up. We're going to be doing monthly webinars. Our first one, we're going to be talking to Bob Holmes. He's a 5-time travel photographer of the year with SATW. And every month we're going to be doing new things. We've also lined up discounts on photo software, camera equipment rentals, and a host of other travel goodies. And you can all check it out at travelphotographyacademy.com. And if you go there before June 1st, you can just sign up for the email, and we will notify you when everything opens up.
Excellent. So I'd say congratulations, but I'll say congratulations when it's actually out, because we've been waiting a long time for this one.
I have been waiting a long time for this. but yeah, it's we're going to be – I know we get some people that have websites that listen to this, so we're going to be having an affiliate program as well. We're probably going to launch that about a month after the site opens. So there will be lots of opportunities.
That's terrific.
All right then. Chris, what's new in the Amateur Traveler this week?
Not much. It actually hasn't been a new show in the last couple weeks. I think the last show we did was the one that you and I did on Israel.
Oh, another award-winning show. One of the, I'd say one of the top 10 shows you've ever done.
Oh, no, actually, the last show I did was on Baden-Württemberg, doing a bicycle trip in southwestern Germany. I was wrong.
Jen, where can people find you online?
Well, I'm in the process of building some new stuff. So just hit me up on Twitter at Jen Leo, and hopefully I can get my act together and get my new stuff in order.
All right. And Max, where can people find you online?
On GoNomad.com. You can find all different things in GoNomad.com and then at GoNomad on Twitter and GoNomad Travel on Facebook.
Excellent. And you can find me at TravelPhotographyAcademy.com. Don't even bother going to my other website. Just forget that for now. Just go to TravelPhotographyAcademy.com. And that's where you can find me. So until next time, get outside and make sure that you have your baggage. Otherwise, it's going to wind up at the Unclaimed Baggage Center.